Hey, it's Lisa Z here from Real Crime Profile. For today's episode, we'd hoped to record part three of our Reeva Steenkamp Oscar Pistorius case analysis, but due to all of our travel schedules, we weren't able to get together. We'll get together next week, in which we'll be able to include Laura and Jim's reaction to Mr. Pistorius' sentencing that is scheduled for July 6th, so never fear, that third episode is on its way. But for today, we have an episode that Jim and Laura recorded with their friend and colleague, Jim Fitzgerald. We think you'll enjoy it. It's about Jim and Jim's early days in the FBI, their early arrests, and their impression of their early career in general. So we hope you'll like it. And next week, we'll be back with Reeva Steenkamp and Oscar Pistorius.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioural analyst, former New Scotland Yard and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service. And I'm really excited today to be in the studio with...
Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler and former New York City prosecutor and currently writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds.
And we're also joined by a very special guest who's come and joined us in the studio tonight... Jim Fitzgerald, former FBI profiler and forensic linguist. So, hey, Fitz.
Great to be here, Laura.
Good to have you on the show. You've been on before, as we know, and I know our listeners. It was a very popular episode of the two Jims talking about an infamous case. But tell us a little bit more about yourself, Fitz, just so that those who didn't hear that episode yet can understand who you are and some of the things you've been up to in your career.
Well, sure, Laura. I was a police officer in suburban Philadelphia, a little town called Bensalem, PA. It wasn't that little, 100 sworn. I was a detective, a sergeant there, and after 11 years, it was time for a move, and I joined the FBI, which is where I met Jim Clemente. And after 7 years in New York, profiler, linguist, and then retired in 07, worked a few big cases during that time frame, one of them being turned into a TV show in 2017, a miniseries. So still busy working and writing and consulting and doing all kinds of good stuff.
And hanging out with Laura and myself a bunch of times too.
And it doesn't get any better than that.
No, it doesn't. How could it?
It certainly doesn't. And certainly we were out at dinner last night at a fantastic Italian restaurant, and the two Jims were regaling various stories about cases and escapades that they'd been on and cases that they'd solved and arrests that they had made. And we just thought it was a fascinating, certainly talking about Jim Clemente's and Jim Fitz's first arrest when they were new rookie FBI agents. And so we thought it would be great to have a bonus episode for our listeners, which is why we slightly switched roles so that I could interview the two Jims together about one particular case. So just for ease, we'll call Jim Fitzgerald Fitz throughout the podcast. And obviously everyone knows Jim Clemente. He needs no more introduction.
Well, thank you, Laura. It is great to be here with you and with Jim Fitz because, well, we've been sort of working together for quite a long time.
Indeed. So we're going to get into some of the stories and certainly, you know, how Fitz and I met. Well, I think we've told listeners before that, in fact, you, Jim C, and I met back in the UK at New Scotland Yard.
Right.
Probably about 15, 16 years ago. But unbeknownst to me, when I first came out to work at the FBI at Quantico, which I was hugely excited to be seconded for 3 months, but I was told that there was a conference, first of all, down in Florida. And I flew across to this conference. I knew nobody there. I knew you were still at Quantico. And I heard a fascinating presentation by someone called James Fitzgerald. And it wasn't just me that he wowed. It was pretty much the 200 to 300 audience that was gathered there when he started to, well, certainly for an hour, gave a presentation around forensic linguistics. And in fact, the subject of the presentation was concepts of
forensic linguistics. And I knew I got your attention when I discussed a case involving New Scotland Yard, a threatened case to blow up a bunch of school buses full of kids. And all of a sudden I put that letter up there and right away You saw some Britishisms, and you actually helped me with that case, Laura.
Oh, well, fantastic. I mean, I vaguely remember that, but I certainly remember you talking for the first time about this thing called an idiolect, which you went on to sort of describe how idiosyncratic, I'm using a lot of long words here, but how idiosyncratic it is when we write. We all have a writing style, and it's very unique to that individual person. And some would say, I've heard it elsewhere, that it's like a fingerprint. And this is something that Fitz has really been pioneering and trailblazing, not just as an FBI profiler, but getting his forensic linguistic master's from Georgetown University. So,
yeah, and it's not just your writing, it's also your speaking voice, right?
Yeah, it definitely is speaking voice, spoken language, as well as written language. And it's strange in my career, the vast majority of my cases involved written language. There are other linguists who specialize in spoken language, who work in accents and dialects from around this country or others. But mine's mostly written, and I've had a relatively decent success rate there.
Yeah, but even if it isn't written down, if it's spoken and transcribed,
of course,
you can analyze it the same way.
And a qualified linguist can compare written language to spoken language.
Right. And it's not the handwriting
nope.
you're looking at, or even necessarily just the words that they're using, but it's how they're used. It's the content that you
sure.
care about.
It's a semantic assessment, a syntactic assessment, and bringing that all together and through punctuation and formatting and grammar and how someone uses a certain noun phrase, verb phrase, if they repeat it, if it's misspelled, if it's, you know, the punctuation's off. These are all things that come together to serve to link a potential set of known writings to a potential set of anonymous writings. And starting with the Unabomber case, I put a few of those cases together, and people still in jail as a result.
Yeah,
and there's certainly another very high-profile case that we've all been reviewing and working on, which we can't say too much about now, but certainly your skill set of taking, shall we say, letters apart and being able to understand certain word choices, and as you said, misspellings can tell you an awful lot about authorial attribution. So we'll get to that at another future point. But certainly, Fitz, I remember you, as Jim C. said, actually asking people in the room to stand up and say certain words. And from the way that they said those words, you incredibly were able to say exactly where they were brought up, or where they'd spent some time, just from the way that they used the word, their pronunciation. And I thought that was pretty impressive at the time.
American English does have various dialects and accents attached to it. And if with enough spoken language and even sometimes written language, you can, in fact, place someone, at least their formative years when they develop their vernacular, in a certain part of the country. And that does help, in fact, solve cases.
So what words do you use, Jim?
It's not the words themselves in most
cases.
It's the pronunciation.
So what words do you ask, though?
Well, my favorite word pairing that tells you a lot about someone is have them... In fact, I'll ask both of you right now. I'm going to spell the word, pronounce it. M-A-R-Y.
Mary.
Mary.
Now, M-E-R-R-Y.
Mary.
Mary.
Okay. Well, I detect slight differences there. But ironically, most of the U.S., people pronounce the name Mary and will say Mary as in Merry Christmas the same way. However, if you're from New York, New Jersey, southeastern Pennsylvania, a little bit in Delaware, you're going to say Mary as in Mary Smith, or you're going to say Murray as in Murray Christmas. And that is one giveaway that you can track someone. Anyone who says Murray Christmas, or they're going to take the ferry boat across the lake, they're originally from New York, New Jersey, southeastern Pennsylvania. Now, it doesn't mean they're living there as we speak, but it means their vernacular years, as we say, their first years or early years when their dialects locked in were from those regions. So that's just one example of how certain words can be pronounced in different parts of the country.
Cool. I certainly recall you doing the one with water as well, and just listening to the range on that one word.
Try it again? How do you say it?
Well, I grew up saying, may I please have a glass of water?
Really?
And where that's a Philadelphia, southeastern Pennsylvania thing, most of the rest of the country says water.
Well, I say water.
Without the R.
Yeah.
Now, that's pronunciations, and we can real quick go into something, the Coke pop soda phenomenon, and that is this country, the U.S., is almost divided on a map in at least two equal parts with Who Says Soda and Who Says Pop when they're referring to, of course, a non-alcoholic bubbly type beverage. However, much of the South uses the generic term Coke to refer to any bubbly. So you may walk into a store in Texas and say, may I have a Coke? What kind? Make it orange. Mm. And there really is no orange Coke.
Right.
So little regionalisms like this. Some people say water fountain. Some people say bubbler. Some people say shopping cart. Some people say carriage. So there's all different words. There's dictionaries that I've helped put together that with all these terms are captured, and you can track down where someone's from.
And I thought it was pretty fascinating hearing you do this presentation. I remember us going out off for lunch after that, and we talked about going back to the academy, and we still hadn't made the link of Jim C. at this point, that you were very good friends with him. I already knew Jim C., and we hadn't joined the dots up.
Yeah.
But we did say that we would spend a bit of time down in Florida before going back to Quantico, and you know, I was very excited about that. We did a number of case consults, I recall, as well, after all the presentations. And this was my first insight, really, into the FBI. And it was various local officers or those attending the conference could bring a case, and a number of profilers would sit round a table. And having had a presentation about the case, then everybody would weigh in with their views and their theories and their thoughts. And then there would be a big discussion and hopefully get to some real insight into the perpetrator or perhaps whether offences were linked.
Right. And if any of our listeners are actually viewers of the show Criminal Minds, which I've been associated with now, we're in our 12th season, that would be sort of the roundtable scenes that we have in the show, depict how we sort of look at a case, analyze it, tear it apart. We each come at it from different perspectives. We each see different things, and we try to help law enforcement solve cases that, without us, for a large part, are unsolvable.
But back at Quantico, it's more of a horseshoe, isn't it? In terms
it is.
Of the
table
rather
is
than
not
a
round
table.
I think they just needed a bigger table for more people.
Yeah, certainly did. And so going back to Quantico, we then arranged to meet Jim C., having realized that we had him in common. And so the three musketeers
got together again, right?
Got together, which was great.
Yeah, because, and we'll talk about it some other time, but Laura and I had met back at New Scotland Yard years before this.
We will. We'll get into it.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, I've enjoyed many years listening to Jim C. and Fitz talk about various cases and endeavours that they've been on. And Fitz and I would do quite a lot of physical training at the FBI as well. I remember my excitement at doing the new agents training and certainly doing the Yellow Brick Road, or being able to do the Yellow Brick Road, which was, for me, very much a dream come true. It probably was most people's nightmares, really. But
yeah.
And those who don't know what the Yellow Brick Road is, well, the opening sequence on the movie Silence of the Lambs really depicts her running through the woods.
Yeah.
And I think it's three clicks down to the assault course. And then the assault course in the woods is another three clicks, and then 3 kilometres back out of there. So it's pretty intensive, and you get your yellow brick at the end of it for those people who complete
it. Yeah, so it's called the Yellow Brick Road, and it's sort of a training milestone, basically, at the FBI Academy, both for new agents and for the National Academy. And basically, it's an obstacle course, it's nets, it's some rock climbing, it's some running through long trenches of mud, and It's kind of an endurance test, but
up and over fences and ropes, and
it's very athletic.
And it's one thing doing it in the spring, summer, or fall, Jim. What time of year did we go through
it? We went through it in the winter, and
very cold winter.
It was very cold, and I remember when I ran through that trench of mud. I don't know what they did. They must have heated it up to break the ice on the top, because it was quite cold that day. But I remember getting one of my shoes sucked into that mud, and I lost it. So I ended up having to take my other shoe off and run the rest of the race with just my socks.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
And ever since then, he was known as
Shoeless
Jim Clemente.
So Shoeless Jim, I haven't heard that one.
Well, you know how it is.
Well, you did it in the middle of winter. I think I did it when there was a black warning on it of 90 degrees heat. So it was really humid. And
well, we did another course at the FBI Academy. Actually, this one is actually on the military base, the Marine base that surrounds the FBI Academy. And it's called the Leadership Reaction Course. And that day we were out there with Bob Rogers, our drill instructor, who was our physical training instructor. And he had us out there running. We would run 5 miles in between each station of this very, very difficult logistic kind of course that you had to do to figure out logistical problems to get, you know, maybe you had a team of five people and you had one 10-foot 2x4 and a 50-gallon barrel and a 4-foot-long rope. And you had to get everybody across this gully filled with water, and they did break the ice on top of that water. And during that day, it had gone to minus 5 or something
definitely
like
below
that.
Zero, on a high, yeah, much lower wind chill temperature.
And it was like minus 20 with the wind chill, and it snowed all day too. So we got about 3 feet of snow. We were down way below zero. And I ended up, I was sick and I didn't want to complain. So I would like run over to the woods and throw up and then come back and keep working. And I had gotten dehydrated. I ended up in the hospital for 3 days after that little jaunt.
Did they call you anything after that one?
Yes, they did, as a matter of fact.
I thought they might have done.
Well, the one last part of that story is while we were doing this training on the Marine Corps base in Quantico, the other side of 95 from the FBI Academy, an actual Marine pulled up in his...
An MP, right.
His Jeep, and got out and said, who's the commanding officer here? And our PT instructor, Bob Rogers, went, all right, it's me, sir. We're here with the FBI agents. You guys are FBI? Because no one should be out today. It's too cold. We're here, sir, and we're going to stay here. You got it. So the Marines weren't out that day. It was too cold.
Right.
But Bob Rogers, 88-2 class, right, was out there running in the cold.
Yeah.
And the two gyms.
Something about Bob. He was a very dedicated guy, and he was really into running. And he basically said if he found out that the missiles were coming over from Russia, he would get his family together, they would say a prayer, and then he'd go out for a 10K run. That's
sounds
how they
like
want to go
kind
out.
Of guy.
Yeah, definitely.
Hardcore.
Yeah, definitely.
We need to take a quick break in the conversation for a word about our sponsor, but we'll be right back. And now, back to the conversation.
So let's get into some of the cases then. I mean, there was one in particular we were talking about last night, which was your first arrest. Is that right,
yeah.
Jim C?
Well, I'll, of course, always remember that. It was kind of an interesting setup. Jim and I were both, I already said we were sitting next to each other in the FBI Academy. We became really good friends. And just by chance, we both wanted to go back to New York. And normally in the FBI Academy, when you get to a certain number of weeks, probably 8 or 10 weeks in, they give you your assignment, where you're going to be stationed for the first 3 to 5 years of your career. And typically that is, well, it's a gamble. They sometimes let you pick a few. Sometimes they let you rank all the offices in the United States, 56 of them, I think, in order of how you, your order of preference. And sometimes some people would get their number one preference and some people will get their 56th preference. So,
but it's never the city you've processed through or where you came from.
Right, never, usually.
Usually,
right.
Except the one exception you're about to tell us.
Right, so at this time in the FBI, they were having so much trouble getting people to stay in the New York office because it was so expensive that they said anybody who was from New York, wanted to go back to New York, could, and anybody who was from outside of New York who wanted to go to New York could. But they offered a bonus of $25,000 to the people who were not from New York. And unfortunately, that didn't apply to people who already lived there. Now, so that means the logic of this is that somebody from Iowa who didn't have to spend thousands of dollars a month on rent for their career or their life up to that point gets $25,000 to sort of get into a place in New York where somebody who's already paying these exorbitant prices and is making exactly the same money as this guy who just came from Iowa, he doesn't get the money. So anyway, it was a difficult thing, but I had to put up with it. Either way, Jim and I got there, and there was kind of a little bit of mix-up with Jim's squad assignment. They had actually assigned him to a squad in the Brooklyn Queens RA, which would have added a lot to your commute. Why, Jim?
Well, I never left Bensalem, Pennsylvania when I joined the Bureau, and my plan was to, in fact, commute every day from the northern suburbs of Philadelphia to lower Manhattan, 70 miles one way, 70 miles back, with about 9.5 hours of work in between.
Right, and that's a minimum of a two-hour drive, right?
A minimum.
Yeah. So then they said he was going to go to the Brooklyn Queens RA, which would have added another hour, sometimes another hour and a half, each way to his commute, which would have been devastating. So luckily, We knew each other, and we talked to the assistant director that first day, and he said, Jim, why don't you go with Jim? That means Jim Fitz, why don't you go with Jim Clementi, and I'll talk to the supervisor, see what we can work out. And lo and behold, we ended up getting assigned to the FBI-NYPD Joint Bank Robbery Task Force together, and that was some amazing work that we did there.
Unheard of for rookies prior to our arrival.
Absolutely.
But in terms of unheard of being posted to that particular...
Yes, because it was a squad for people who are very experienced. At the time, in New York City, we had 2,000 bank robberies a year, and that's a lot of work. So you can do the math. There's 365 days a year. It's about... What? Jim's making a face.
Yes.
That may include the entire division, including Long Island... and Westchester County, and note jobs. We only handled the arm jobs, if you remember.
No, I know. No, we didn't. We did note jobs as long as there were more than three, right? You had to have a pattern before we did it. But there were 2,000 bank robberies.
There were many, many bank robberies every year when we first got there.
But there were 2,000. Sure. Okay. I remember the number, so I'm not going to, fake it. I'm just saying there were 2,000 bank robberies. And, bank robberies, including armed robberies or threats of violence.
And armored car robberies, too.
And armored car robberies, you're right. Absolutely right. We had at least a few of those.
At least a dozen every year.
Yeah. So anyway, we got assigned to the same squad, and, we were the new guys. And they would kind of give us sort of what we would call the shit leads. The things that nobody else wanted to do, they would sort of pawn off on us. And we had a training agent. You want to talk about our training agent, Jim?
Smokey Stover. She cursed more and smoked more than any guy on our squad combined.
Yeah, she was a chain smoker, and she was definitely not a dainty person, I would say.
You're being very euphemistic here, even in the way you put that. But her smoking was so bad, we actually chipped in and bought her, back then it wasn't cheap, maybe $25, one of these ashtrays that had a little fan built into it and a filter, and it was run by batteries, and she reluctantly agreed to use that ashtray when she was chain smoking. So helped us out a little bit in the squad area.
But this was when you could smoke in a government building, and she would typically have a cigarette going every single hour, every single minute of the day.
And you said sometimes it was even two.
Yeah, sometimes she would walk to the copy machine and forget that she had a cigarette lit, so she'd light another one and come back and be smoking two.
Then she'd curse like a sailor once she realized she had two cigarettes going. So it was quite a sensory situation with her.
Yeah. But anyway, so one of those leads that she gave me, actually, was on a guy who was an I.O. An I.O. is an acronym for Identification Order. And that just means that somebody who is on sort of the next up to become a top 10, in other words, he's been identified as somebody that they want to put on the top 10 fugitive list, the FBI's 10 most wanted, and they're just waiting for one of the other people in the top 10 to have gotten arrested so that they can then put the next top guy in there. So he was one of those people. His name, Paul Noring. His crime, child abduction and child sexual assault. So he's not a good guy.
But he wasn't a bank robber, in terms of your remit on your unit?
Yeah, my unit, it was the joint FBI-NYPD bank robbery squad, but it was also the violent crimes unit of the FBI. So we were all housed on the same squad. And we all did all the work.
So it was interchangeable in terms of which cases you might, or which leads you might follow up and investigate, or lines of inquiry, as we would call them.
Yes, definitely. So this became one of my assignments to try to track down this guy. And it was my understanding that they had been looking for this fugitive for 3 years. He's been on the lam for 3 years. And I remember basically getting sort of all the shit leads from our...
Can we use that word, by the way, in your podcast?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
All right. And when we... One of the leads, I had to go up and interview this guy in Harlem who happened to be a transsexual. And when I knocked on the door, he showed up at the door in a pair of tidy whities with shaving cream on his legs and a razor in his hand. And his hair tied up in a bun and makeup on. And apparently he was getting ready to transform into a woman for the night. And he invited me in. And while he's shaving his legs, he's answering my questions. And I found out that he had had an association with Paul Noring. And he said, I think I have a picture of him here. And he found me a picture, a Polaroid picture of Paul Noring with another guy. And in the background of that picture, I saw the sign. And it, the left side of the sign was blocked, but the right side of the sign said Imports. So I figured that was the company that this guy might work at, the guy that was in the picture with the fugitive. And I figured, well, that's at least a good lead. So,
and where was Fitz at this stage? Were you with him or were you...
I don't think I made it to the cross-dresser Harlem apartment. I would have remembered
you might
that,
remember.
I'm
sure.
I don't know. I was, it was by myself at that okay. point. But, you know, hey, I was a young agent. I wanted to do my job and do everything I had to do to track this fugitive down. It was my mission and I wasn't going to let it go.
And a question, Jim C. I mean, back in the day, were there such a thing as intelligence analysts or intelligence officers? Did anyone develop intelligence for you, or were you just given a line of inquiry and you just have to go out and action it?
That's absolutely what we had to do, right, Jim?
Yeah, on our particular squad, I mean, there were analysts, investigative assistants, these types of folks throughout the New York division, but our squad, it was us and detectives, and we had to do it all.
Yeah.
And how many on the squad?
About 10 agents and 10 detectives, a couple, you know, a supervisor and like an assistant supervisor, but about 20, 22.
That's not very many. I mean, for the volume that you've described and the nature of the work, that's quite a small squad.
Oh, yeah. We were out chasing down either armored car or bank robberies.
Kidnappers,
child abductors, child sex crimes offenders. We were out there every day. It wasn't a slow day ever.
And we got called in at least 1 week in a month.
Oh, yeah, where we had to work over the week, through the weekend because of some emergency. But so when I got back to the office, back then it was before the internet, and I pulled out the Yellow Pages, which is our book with businesses in it.
And yeah, it's the same in the UK, actually, Yellow Pages, back in the day.
Okay. And I went through the Yellow Pages and looked for every business that was named something Imports. And I started making a list of those names and those addresses. And I told Fitz, hey, you doing anything? You want to come out and, we used to call it, shag some leads. I know that means something a little different.
It certainly does mean something different in the UK.
You, Laura,
shag in the city of Leeds, right? I mean,
right.
That's a whole different meaning.
Yeah, there's a whole different context going on here for listeners in the UK.
Which means just sort of shoe leather. It's basically get out on the streets and follow down leads and talk to people and check out addresses and so on and so forth. So
I'm glad you clarified that.
I know.
Luckily, we have a linguist in the room.
Yes.
Thank goodness.
And somebody who can translate for us in the UK. So we got in our bureau car and started driving around the city to these different addresses to check out whether or not we can locate anybody that looked like they were in this picture.
What were the bureau cars at that time?
Oh, they were those big, what's it called?
Well, this is about March of 88. We're literally in the office about 2 weeks. And so the newer, the senior agents had maybe 1987, 1988, nice Crown Vics and other, you know, GM type cars.
And the new rookies?
I think we were driving around early 80s something or other.
Plymouth, I think.
Yeah, but it did start, it did stop, and that's probably all we needed.
Yeah, and the other thing you should know about when you're an FBI agent in New York City, there's only a limited number of parking spaces in the building and around the perimeter of the building, so we generally had to park in a lot that basically it took about 45 minutes to go get your car. You had to walk like 20 minutes from the building and then get somebody to go get your car, and then they could be gone 20 minutes, and then you had to drive 5 minutes back to the building. So
not very agile for chasing the bad guys down.
No,
you've got to come out and wait for your car to be delivered.
Right, so we had a lot of guys who would park right on the street. It's sort of illegal parking, but they had their medallions on the front. We actually got into a situation with the New York City Parking Authority where they were actually trying to tow FBI cars from in front of the federal building. And it literally got to the point where agents were pulling their guns out and saying, you cannot take that. That's federal property. You can't take that.
You can't steal our car.
It's illegal. And we're allowed to park here. We're not constrained by New York City ordinances. You cannot force a federal official to follow a city law because there's a federal supremacy clause. And so it literally got down to almost shootouts over our cars. It was really crazy. But anyway, on this day, I remember we pulled into something imports by the on the east side.
Was it the leather district or the fashion district? Are they kind of the same?
I think it was in the seaport, though. I thought it was on the east side.
Like Tribeca? No, that wouldn't
be. It was north. It was right where they would later develop the seaport.
Okay.
Right below the Brooklyn Bridge, I believe.
Okay.
Right in that area. And we pulled up to a loading dock, parked the car, and asked some guy who was working there if he would tell us where the manager or the president was. And he told us it's on the second floor. You can take that elevator up there. And we get up to the second floor, and lo and behold, as the doors open, there's a guy waiting to come in the elevator, and he sees us, and he says, "Can I help you?" And I recognize him from the photo that this guy had given me, and he's standing in this photo right next to the fugitive. So I said, "Yeah, I'd like to talk to the manager or the president of the company, and can you bring me there?" Because I didn't want to lose sight of him. And he said yes, so he walked Fitz and I, into the president's office. And when he did, we both pulled out our FBI credentials, identified ourselves, and said, "We need to talk to this guy right now in your office." And we got his name, we sat him down at the desk, and we sat opposite him, and I started asking him questions. And that went on for quite a while. Now, Jim wasn't as familiar with the case because I had basically just asked him to come with me and follow these leads. So he kind of just sat there quietly. And I could tell as I was asking this guy questions that he kept looking nervously at Jim, like, why isn't he talking? What's going on in his mind? And he got more and more and more nervous. And he was lying to me. I could tell he was avoiding. He was saying he didn't know this guy and so on and so forth. And then I looked over to Jim and I'm like, you know, indicating to him he should sort of get in his face. So what did you do, Jim?
Well, first of all, silence can speak volumes at times. And yes. We developed our teamwork early on at the academy.
Mm-hmm.
And this was now a real case scenario. We were working it. Jim was doing just fine in his interview. I knew the guy was lying too. I could look at his deception indicators, his face, his twitches, those micro expressions. We used to refer to different things back in the day than they do now. But all of a sudden, I knew this guy was just pushing buttons in the wrong way, and I decided to stand up, walk over to the desk, and all of a sudden slam both hands down as hard as I could on his desk and saying, "You are a lying sack of shit. Now you're going to tell Agent Clemente the truth of what you know starting right now."
So Jim got a little emphatic when he said that. He's kind of controlled in the way he's saying it right now.
So it's a good cop, bad cop routine going down.
Silent cop to bad cop. And then Jim was kind of sort of hybrid in the middle. And
yeah.
There.
So at that point, I had gotten pretty frustrated with the fact that this guy was lying. And what I was thinking that we would do is just surveil him after he left work that day, because I didn't think he was going to actually say anything. So I just sort of pretended I was restraining Jim and said, "Come on, Jim, don't get in his face. Come on, you know." And the guy's like shaking at this point, and he says, "What if I tell you what I know?" And we both looked at each other like, "Well, I guess that would be all right, you know." And so the guy said, "Yeah, I just went into business with him. We opened an import-export store, a lot like Art Vandelay, for any Seinfeld fans out there. And he told me it was on 61st Street."
It was a leather shop.
It was leather goods. It was importing, exporting leather goods, bags and portfolios and briefcases and so forth. And he said it's on the corner of 61st and 2nd Street, I believe. And so we were quite a distance away. I mean, quite a distance away because we were down around the Wall Street area at the time. And so we gave him a warning not to call the guy. And we got in the car. And
well, hold on, Jim. I remember telling him specifically, the only other thing I said to him is, as of right now, we're monitoring your phones from Washington, D.C. You make one call, we'll know. We'll be back here and arrest you. Yes, agent, I will not call anyone.
There you go.
And he never did.
He never did. So I was at the wheel. We drove up to the Upper East Side of Manhattan. It was kind of rush hour and lots of traffic. I remember at least once or twice kind of driving up a little bit on the sidewalk to get around a traffic jam and so forth. But we were on a mission, and it was an important one.
And it was a little scary riding shotgun next to Jim Clemente through the streets of Manhattan, but we did manage to make it there in one piece.
Only no accidents.
Only a few squirrels and pigeons lost their lives that day.
No.
Any foxes?
No, not that time. So we get there. We drive past this new shop. It's very brand new, very she, as we would say. Posh might be the way you would say it, Laura. And we look through the whole glass front. You could see into the back of the shop, and there, sitting on a stool, overseeing this shop, is Paul Noring. And Jim and I looked at him. I parked the car maybe 30 feet down the street. We got out. We came up with a quick
arrest plan.
Were you surprised that he was there?
I was very surprised because this is somebody that had been a fugitive from the federal government for 3 years. And here he is sitting there managing a leather goods import and export.
And we're basically 3 weeks into our career post-graduation.
Right. So, and this is an IO. This is an important arrest. This
you
is
knew
somebody,
he was a big deal.
Yes. And so we get out of the car. I said, Jim, how about this? I'll go in. I'll talk to him, engage him, see if there's anybody else in there. And then you can come in and I'll...
So you're discussing this outside.
Outside.
So you got out of your car and you stood outside just quickly, you know, putting a strategy together.
Yes, there was nobody else that we could see in the shop. So I wanted to make sure, A, that it was safe, that there was nobody else there. And B, I wanted to make sure that he didn't get away. So I made sure that when I got into the shop, I sort of maneuvered my way so that I was between him and the back of the shop, as in the exit. And Jim walked in the front door and he said to Fitz, I'll be with you in a moment. And I was asking him about some briefcases or something.
We also, it was important to get him away from the counter, the desk, the register, because if he had any kind of a weapon, we knew it may be there. Yeah. So we made sure he was like 10 or 15 feet away.
Right. And I said, I'll talk to him. You come in while I'm in the middle of talking to him. If you can pull out your credentials and then identify yourself as he turns around to you, I'll put the cuffs on him and we'll be done. And that's exactly how it went down. So I was talking to him, asking him about different products, looking around, making sure, checking to see if there was a back area where anybody was. Couldn't see anybody back there. And I'm asking him, oh, is this brand new place? Yeah. And I said, oh, are you the owner? And he said, yes, I am. And I said, wow. I said, but you have to be here all the time by yourself? And he goes, yeah, you know, we're just new, so we don't have a lot of business yet. So I found out he was there alone. And then I went, I looked at some more things. And as Jim came in and he turned to Jim, and Jim pulled out his credentials and said, FBI. And you could see the blood drain from his face. Do you remember that?
Very much so.
Yeah. And so I put the handcuffs on him, and I sat him down on the stool I had originally seen him on, and I picked up the phone, and I called the bank robbery squad downtown. I remember it clearly. One of the detectives answered the phone, Chris Montanino. Great guy, Chris, and his wife was an FBI agent. Becky Montanino, yeah. And they were a great law enforcement couple. And I said to Chris, hey, how you doing? He goes, hey, John was our supervisor. John wants to know where the gyms are. What are you guys up to? And I said, well, we just arrested Paul Noring. And he said, yeah, right. Okay, so tell me, where are you? Because John is asking where you are. And I said, well, we're on 61st Street and 2nd Avenue at a shop, a leather goods shop. We arrested Paul Noring. And he said, stop fooling around. I'm going to tell John. And I was like, I'm not fooling around. We arrested Paul Noring. Where are we supposed to take him? He goes, yeah, take him down to the court then. And I was like, what? Aren't we going to fingerprint him and photograph him and interrogate him? I mean, what's that all about? And he goes, come on, stop kidding around. I said, what? Can you just put John on the phone so I could tell him we arrested Paul Noreen? He goes, you're shitting me. Because the whole squad had been looking for this guy for 3 years, right? So the two newbies on the squad go out one day and we arrest the guy. So anyway, we bring him in, bring him up to an interrogation room, and somebody came from the squad to sort of babysit him for a minute because we were ordered unceremoniously into our supervisor's office. And why don't you tell him what happened when we got in there, Jim Fitz?
Well, it used to be called being read the Riot Act, and we were because we shouldn't have made this arrest on our own. We should have notified the squad. We should have had a full written arrest plan sent to the supervisor beforehand, and NYPD put on notice, helicopters, and you name it.
Yeah.
I was kidding about the last part, but everything else was there. And the bottom line is John, our supervisor, was pretty upset that we did this on our own. But Jim, to our defense, it happened all so quickly. We didn't even know this guy would be in the leather store. All of a sudden, he is. There's a back door exit. We thought we better get in there, secure the area. We did. And
We didn't have any way, because there were only two of us, we didn't have any way of actually securing the front and the back at the same time other than walking right in there. And so we made a call. I had been a former prosecutor. You had been a former police officer. We weren't actually newbies to law enforcement.
Right.
But to him, our squad supervisor, we were. But I think we also found out there was another layer to this. But the second in command, Steve Carbone, he was the bank robbery coordinator or manager, program manager, and he came up to us and sort of patted us on the back and said, don't worry about all that. You guys did a good job. And it turns out, we were told sort of on the side, that the reason why our supervisor was pissed off was that when somebody is an IO, in other words, they're going to be a top 10 soon, well, apparently some agents would have you find out as much information as you could about the guy, but not find him. And then when he becomes a top 10, use that information to then arrest a top 10, because that's a big deal in the FBI. Well, to me, that's like leaving a dangerous person on the streets, and it's totally irresponsible. And it wasn't anything that I would be part of anyway, so I'm glad we did it. How about you?
That makes two of us, and Paul Noreen was off the streets after that for a real long time.
Yes, and what was funny, though, was our training agent was not in the office when we brought him in, but we were up doing the photographing and taking his fingerprints in another room up in the upper floors of the office, and I'm standing at the doorway, and I see her coming down the hallway, and if I'm not mistaken, she literally had steam coming out her ears. She was really pissed off. She was marching down the hallway, and apparently the guys on the squad had said, oh my God, you really messed up leaving those two Jims alone because they screwed up. They did, you know, they arrested the wrong guy, and they got some crazy man up there and all this other stuff. So she came in. She pushed right past me and saw Paul Noreen sitting there, somebody she had been hunting for 3 years, and she literally lost her breath. She was like, and she fell back against the door and almost slid down to the floor saying, Paul. And he goes, do I know you? And she goes, well, I feel like I know you. I've been following you for 3 years. Anyway, it was kind of funny, and she had to admit that we did a good job, despite the fact that we were rookies.
The newbies. It sounds like you did a great job. And can you say anything else about who he was and what he did?
Well, he was a fugitive for abducting children and also sexually assaulting children. So he had a number of prior convictions, but I think that it was a local state, a New Jersey conviction that he actually was able to escape from custody and then became a fugitive became a federal fugitive because he had crossed state lines with several of his crimes. So they wanted to make him a top 10. I think it was because Director Louis Free at the time, he would have been the first top 10 who was a child abductor, child sex crime offender. And I believe it was Louis Free. Jim's making a face. Was it Webster?
It may have been Webster at that point. But I think what you're saying is right, though. They wanted to get a child molester in the top 10 and a legitimate one. And this guy certainly would have been one.
Yeah. So anyway, we got him off the street. I don't think that he would have. He was put away for a long time. And I don't think he would have ever gotten out.
Well, it does sound like a great job. And just as you said, Jim C., you know, had he been left on the streets for any longer, you know, how many other victims would he abduct and molest?
Exactly. I mean, I'm sure that my supervisor probably would have said, well, we'll put surveillance on him and, you know, find out what he's doing and where he's living and all that stuff. But the fact is that unless you can...
Still a risky business, isn't it?
Even unless you can watch him 24 hours a day, every second of those days, you never know what the hell he's doing. Anyway, that was our first arrest together, and it would not be the last.
Yeah, Jim's was sort of a sub-squad from the bank robbery squad, but he would help us out with bank robberies as well as the other agent and detectives, and I would occasionally help their squad out on the sexual victimization of children cases. And so it was kind of a great experience. And I had done that as a police officer. I made many arrests for rapes and sexual assault. So it was nice sort of at the federal level being involved in those cases too and putting guys away. And one of the next arrests was, unfortunately, one of our own agents who was abusing some boys out in Long Island.
Right.
And I was a soccer coach and all that.
Richard Taus.
And you and I put some time into that along with some other agents and detectives. And eventually he was arrested. He's still in jail. And he's claiming now, by the way, it's all a CIA frame-up.
Mm.
And these 14-year-old boys were all plants by the CIA.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how these guys will take advantage of
and try and manipulate the system.
And bring people in their little conspiracy theories.
I know. Well, what's interesting, though, is that we, and Jim kind of mentioned this, we had a lot of sub-squads on this bank robbery task force. They called it bank robbery task force because I think that was sort of a legendary task force with the NYPD and the FBI. It had been a long-standing task force and may have been one of the first ones. And one of the violations that we worked was child sex crimes and child abductions, sexual exploitation of children. I worked with both Chris Montanino and Joe Gelfand. And Joe was a great detective too, really nice guy, very soft-spoken, and he could make friends with anybody. He could get any hardened criminal to talk to him because he was just so nice and polite and cordial to them. And at first, I was like, how can you do that? But I saw the magic work. I saw how easily he could get people to open up, even about these horrendous crimes. And I really learned a lot from Joe. He became my greatest mentor in this field. So hats off to you, Joe Gelfand.
You're out there somewhere.
New York City.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now seems like a good time to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the conversation.
So it sounds like, you know, great times and fascinating cases, and the two Jims certainly making sure that New York was a lot safer. And in that particular case, you know, someone who was a child abductor and child molester was taken off the street. So it's been fascinating talking to you both, as always. And I know we're going to circle back, come bring Fitz back into the studio and talk more about your cases and various adventures that you've both been on.
There's many more, even just within the first year and a half of our time in New York.
Oh, yeah. We got into car chases and bank burglaries and all sorts of crazy stuff, armored car robberies.
Mob hunts with the killer of Everett Hatcher, the DEA agent, finally with Gus Faraci. We'll tell that one next time.
Yeah.
Whilst making videos and various other talents that we'll get back to at some point, too.
That video we made at the FBI Academy was the first, but it's certainly not the last. We're actually have in production now Manifesto, and it's the story of Jim Fitzgerald's chase after the Unabomber and how he used forensic linguistics to hunt him down.
Yeah, I'm working with the Discovery Channel folks now, and it will be aired in July of 2017. So I'll be back before then, and we'll talk about that some more.
Awesome.
We'll certainly have you back here. And have you got any other recommendations, Fitz?
Laura and Jimmy have been nice enough before. My book, A Journey to the Center of the Mind by James R. Fitzgerald, my memoir in three parts. Book two will be out in a few months, and book three will be all these cases we're talking about in the FBI. Will be one per chapter, and we'll have some fun there too.
Yeah, what's great about the book is he's able to go into great detail about these cases and many more. So it's really a great read and really interesting stuff. So you should pick it up.
Absolutely, and we can link it in with our Twitter and Facebook feed as well. So I'm just going to give one recommendation, which is actually a show the three of us were in called Killer Profile, which was, I think it aired in 2012, where we discussed six serial killers. So I think it's still available. You can still see it on certainly Stage 3 Productions and maybe on LMN. So check that out when you get a chance.
That's right. It was great. It was a series, an original series that we created together. And we talked about serial killers that you really didn't hear much about in the news beforehand. But every one of them, there was a victim who survived. We chose those cases so that we could show people how somebody's instinct to live can actually overcome even serial killers.
And what was just as interesting about that series, albeit a short one, was in each one we had the actual words of the killer himself talking many times into a video camera about why he chose to kill and why how he chose his victims.
And some of them were, I mean, body counts upwards of 20. And I certainly remember the New Orleans before Hurricane Katrina. I think that we had identified at least three active serial killers operating at that time.
At the same time. It was outrageous. It was unbelievable.
Which is incredible. So do have a look at that. And that's all we've got time for on this Real Crime Profile. But Fitz would definitely be back, as will Jim C. and I and Lisa.
Well, it's great being here. And thanks for coming, Fitz.
Glad to be here.
So thank you so much for listening. And we'll be back very soon.
So if you like our show and you want to help us out, there are a couple things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and leave us a positive 5-star review. You can also like our Facebook page and join in on some great questions, comments, and conversations. We always love to hear from you there. You can follow us on Twitter. You can check out our sponsors. And most importantly, you can share us with friends, family, and anyone you know who's interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. Thanks for listening.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799 7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.